In just a moment, Jerome Kern, the man and his music. But first, how long since you've read a good bestseller or enjoyed a performance of the theater or met some really stimulating people? Well, you can do all these things tomorrow and every Monday through Friday and without neglecting your daily routine either. Yes, it's weekday, NBC's wonderful daytime radio service, bringing right into your own home a new novel, First Train to Babylon, another complete short story, and interesting guest personalities, singer John Raitt, composer Robert Russell Bennett, and many others. You'll hear it all on weekday tomorrow. Now stay tuned for Jerome Kern, the man and his music on NBC.
The National Broadcasting Company presents Jerome Kern, the man and the music, an NBC News biography in sound. What you're listening to is some of the most memorable popular music of our century. In the next 55 transcribed minutes, you'll hear more of that music and more about Jerome Kern, the man who wrote it, told in the voices of those who knew him best. Among Kern's closest friends was his arranger, Robert Russell Bennett.
I think I've seen Kern in practically every aspect in the world, and of course it would be silly for me to say I ever understood him, because I didn't.
Another close friend was the playwright and lyricist Oscar Hammerstein II.
Jerry called me up and said he had read half of a book, and he thought it would be great for us. And I said, what book is that? And he said, Edna Ferber's Showboat.
Rare book expert Tony Bade knew Kern best through a hobby.
Jerome Kern was well known and greatly loved by most of the booksellers of America. And it has always been said that when he found an item he liked, he never haggled on the price.
And Edna Ferber shared with Kern a never-to-be-forgotten moment.
He played and sang the music he had just written. The music mounted and mounted, and I give you my word, my hair stood on end. Tears came to my eyes. I knew that this wasn't just a musical comedy number.
In just a moment, you'll share these and other recollections of Jerome Kern. First, a message from RCA and RCA Victor.
Hello, this is Vaughn Monroe for RCA. If you own an RCA Victor television, let me introduce you to a man you can depend on for continuous top performance.
I'm an RCA service company technician, and as Vaughn says, it's my job to keep America's finest television sets delivering the very best performance.
Tell me, how did you qualify for your job?
Well, like all RCA service company technicians, I received thorough training in RCA factory methods by RCA engineers.
And how long ago did you finish your training?
My training is never really finished, Vaughn. To keep up with my job, I still attend periodic clinics on current advances in electronics. We RCA service company technicians service only RCA Victor television. And that's why we know your RCA Victor television set best.
RCA service company branches are located in most TV areas. Look for the one nearest you under television service in your classified directory.
And now, NBC News presents Jerome Kern, the man and the music, a biography in sound. Your narrator is Kenneth Banghart.
Jerome David Kern, born 1885, died 1945, just 10 years ago this month.
During his span of 60 years, the world did everything but turn inside out. It staggered from horse-drawn carriage to jet-propelled plane, through two global wars, a major depression, and a host of lesser mishaps. In all this chaos, the melodies of Jerome Kern have not only survived, they've become a sort of ideal standard for later composers of popular music to aim at. And nowadays, when someone says they don't write music like that anymore, he may unconsciously be paying his respects to Jerome Kern, an owlish little man in horn-rimmed glasses who, as Andre Castellanos put it, looked less a musician than any man I've ever known. Perhaps the mere statistics indicate the power of his impact. Kern was the composer of melodies for more than 50 musical comedies, and at the time of his death, at least 15 of his songs had passed the 2 million mark in record sales. But statistics are only the outer garment of a man's genius. For the full story, you must look at the man himself and at the boy behind the man.
Well, it just happened that I was brought up in Elmhurst, Long Island, with Jerome Kern.
That's Joseph Myron, the son of an actor who was very popular just at the turn of the century. Today, Joseph Myron runs a hotel down in Nassau in the British West Indies. In 1897, he was one of Jerome Kern's neighborhood pals.
Jerry was a wistful, sensitive kid whose only interest seemed to be music. He was a very, very nervous type and very retiring. And in the schoolyard, he was always in a lot of trouble because there were a lot of antagonistic boys there and everything could make fun of a little fellow like that. The kids at school used to gang up on him, the bullies around the schoolyard, and some of us protected him because we respected his piano playing. My father gave me a good allowance, and I used to turn it into candy and bribe the bullies with nuggets of sweetness to keep him from getting a bloody nose.
That candy, in the light of after events, was well invested in it. After high school, Jerry Kern studied at the New York College of Music, where he was a good but not a brilliant student. And then after a rather unsuccessful fling at the family's furniture business, his father saw the wisdom of additional music study, this time in Europe. Kern sailed in 1903. It was in London he met the American producer Charles Frohman. Guy Bolton, later to become a Kern collaborator and film biographer, remembers what happened next.
Jerry had tried during his quite early beginnings in New York to get to see Frohman. He never was able to obtain an introduction to him. And Frohman at that time was completely sold on doing English shows, both musicals and straight plays. And after Jerry had gone to England, he had written a number. There, Charles Frohman heard the number and asked to meet Jerry and made a proposal to him that he should come to America with him and write extra numbers. He said that you Englishmen have a way of writing this type of number so much better than any of our boys do, and I'd like to have you over there. So Jerry didn't disillusion him on the matter of his being an Englishman and sailed with him. And when they reached New York, Frohman, rather proudly pointing out sights as they came up the harbor, saying, "That's the Statue of Liberty, and that building with the gold dome on it is the World Building," when a woman came up to Jerry and said, "I've been in my cabin all the way over, and I didn't know you were here. And how are your family out in Newark?"
Frohman, they say, got a big kick out of Jerry's deception and his embarrassment at being found out, for they later became good friends. Temporarily, though, Kern had to take a job on Tin Pan Alley, not as a composer, but as a pianist. And it was there he met his first American collaborator.
I guess I had the relative part in his career that the Tin Lizzie had in the career of the Ford automobile.
Edward Lasker, 21 years old at the time we're talking about, and already a lad with a growing reputation.
I dropped in to see a producer who had a show just opened out of town, at which I'd written practically the song here, an Indian song called Sweet Little Caribou. And I asked him if he needed anything for the show. He said, yes, I want a duet for Joe Myron. I can see the idea of writing a sort of a burlesque song around the Wade Spoon. And I got to the Palms. There was Jerry playing away. Jerry, I said, we got a song to do. I've been in to see Pearlie, and he wants us to do a duet. And I got the idea that How Would You Like to Spoon With Me would be an idea. And then to write humorous burlesque lyrics to it. Great, he said. Well, what have you got? So he took the title and he pushed it around for about 5 minutes and had a corking melody. Okay, I said, shoot me a verse, and back came a verse in just as long as it takes to play it now. So I went home, wrote the lyric that evening. Next day, down to Kane. We rehearsed. Over to Paley. Some women came in after us, and the office boy let them in before us. And Kane was very uppish. He said, come on, we'll go over to Alf Heyman. So I told the girl we'd be back later. We went over to Alf Heyman. He was Promo's general manager. He liked the song, only he said the White Spoon wouldn't be understood in London. I said, well, that's really the crux of the song, but I'll see what I can do overnight. We got out on the street, and Jerry said, no, we wouldn't change the way. I said, let's go over to Schubert's. We went over to Schubert's, and they were rehearsing Eddie Foy to be starred in The Elle and the Girl. Sam Schubert came out, and Jerry said, Mr. Schubert, we're proteges of Reginald de Koven. I was more surprised than Schubert because I didn't know who we were until then. So Schubert took us right into a piano. Jerry played, I sang, and Sam Schubert was wild about it. He said, we'll feature it in The Elle and the Girl immediately.
How'd You Like to Spoon With Me became Kern's first big song hit. After it was written, Lasker went on to become a successful songwriter and dramatist. And Kern continued his search for a publisher. Robert Russell Bennett, who later became Kern's arranger and close friend, takes up the story.
There was a Mr. Max Dreyfus, who is quite a powerful man in the world of light music. And to be in with the Dreyfus brothers was a great feather in any composer's cap. And finally, Kern made it. Some friends got him in to see Mr. Dreyfus. When he went into the office, now bear in mind that this is a long, long time ago, he went into the office of the Dreyfus brothers, and he saw on the piano a silk hat and a stick, walking stick, and the gentlemen in the office were all dressed in frock coats. Well, that impressed Jerome B. Kern very, very much, and he went back to his wife, and he said, my, this is a high-class organization. I'm certainly glad that I'm in with a place like that. It's really the big leagues. But he found out about 3 weeks later that the whole outfit had been out to play a wedding that afternoon and they were dressed accordingly.
The Dreyfus brothers, it might be added, soon found it unnecessary to balance the budget by playing at weddings, thanks in part to their new property, Jerome Kern. At this date, though, Broadway producers were not ready to trust Kern with a score for an entire show. But he did find a way to get a foot in the door. Guy Bolton remembers it well.
It was the custom then. They were putting on all these Austrian musical comedies, and they always wanted a couple of American hit numbers in them. And the other songwriters used to try and find out ahead of time, listen at doors and employ a grapevine to discover when one of these things was going to be done. But Jerry wouldn't do that. He'd wait till they'd been rehearsing for a couple of weeks. And then he would turn up at the rehearsal with the portfolio under his arm and say, do you want any numbers? And they would say, no, we've got all the interpolated numbers we need. And he said, oh, it's too bad. I had something that I thought would interest you. By this time, they were quite tired. And they would say, sit down at the piano and play. And in those days, he played very well. So he'd perform these numbers, and they would throw some other number out and put one of Kern's in. Very crafty dodge.
Among those interpolated songs was one Kern wrote for the girl from Utah. The title, They Didn't Believe Me.
Thank you.
now, the name Jerome Kern was becoming familiar in New York professional circles. It became more so when he began to write, with Guy Bolton and P.G. Woodhouse, a series of unique musical shows for the Princess Theater. The shows were successful, and so were the Kern melodies. A theatrical triumvirate had been born. Here's a notation on that subject from the scrapbook of P.G. Woodhouse.
This is what George Kaufman wrote in FPA's column. This is the trio of musical fame, Bolton and Woodhouse and Kern. Better than anyone else you can name, Bolton and Woodhouse and Kern. Nobody knows what on earth they've been bitten by. All I can say is I mean to get litten by orchestra seats for the next one that's written by Bolton and Woodhouse and Kern.
In these years, Kern's name appeared frequently in the copy of Broadway columnists. It also showed up quite often on the passenger lists of ships headed for Europe. On one of these occasions, he was set to go with Charles Frohman, the producer who had imported Kern from England just 10 years earlier, Guy Bolton.
Frohman asked him to go back to England with him, and Jerry arranged to do so. He went to a party the night before he was going to sail, when a lot of friends were wishing him well, and drinks were flowing quite freely, and he had left an order to be called very early in the morning, and he had asked them to wake him at 6. And he woke up about that time, but wasn't called. However, that didn't disturb him very much. He started to get dressed, and while he was dressing, it kept getting darker and darker, and he became convinced that it was going to be a dreadful day, and a horrible day in which to sail away from New York. He went downstairs with a couple of bags, got in a taxi, and said to the taxi driver, "What's happening to the weather?" The taxi driver said, "What's wrong with it?" And he said, "Well, it's getting so dark." He said, "It should get dark. It's nearly 7 o'clock. Jerry had slept right through the day, and by doing so, he missed sailing with Frohman on Frohman's last voyage on the Lusitania.
On May 17, 1915, just a few miles off the Irish coast, the Lusitania was torpedoed by a German submarine, and Charles Frohman was among those who died. Eventually, though, the war ended, and there was no Broadway season that didn't have at least 2 Kern shows. By 1925, Kern was working with one of the most famous musical comedy writers of them all, the man who later wrote the words for this Kern melody. The Kern song, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, written for the Broadway production of Roberta. But the first show these men worked on together was Sonny. That was in 1925.
As I knew him in the beginning, Jerry didn't have much to say except when he did say it. He said it in a very loud and imperious way so that everybody knew what he meant and that he meant everything that he said. He came to me at that time as a very volatile, imperious sort of chap. But I learned afterwards that was more or less of, I wouldn't say an act that he put on, but I feel that was his way of overcoming what I later learned was the timidity about speaking in the presence of more than his intimates. I remember once hearing Oscar Hammerstein say, "Jerry was a man who might anger you, but he certainly would never bore you." And that was very true, as I have had occasion to witness many times. Particularly, let us say somebody had gotten a chance to audition for him. A boy or a girl who had spoken his piece or sung his song might have gone away with the idea that Jerry was a very austere and a very severe man, because he pulled no punches in expressing his opinion, either as to the ability or the inability of the young people who had auditioned for him. I'm sure that some of the young people that I have seen stand in awe of him while meeting him for the first time would have been certainly surprised to see him at other moments. I remember once we were having a dinner party at the home of Max Dreyfus, his publisher. There must have been 25 or 30 people seated around that big dinner table. And I noticed that Jerry seemed to be busy with something that had to do with his napkin, I thought. When suddenly he got up from the table, marched around the room and made his exit with no trousers on. Of course, it was greeted with shrieks of laughter from everybody present, but it only indicated there was in Jerry an irrepressible kid that would have his way at times.
All his friends say of Jerry Kern that he was a man of boundless energy, and even a back-breaking load of work didn't exhaust the supply. His hobbies, therefore, were numerous, and the predominant one was the collection of rare books.
Jerome Kern was well known and greatly loved by most of the booksellers of America and England as well. And it has always been said by the various dealers that when he found an item he liked, he never haggled on the price.
The voice of Tony Bain. He's an expert on rare books and the auctioneer Kern turned to when he became worried about his own collection.
He had this valuable library in his modest home in Bronxville, New York. There was a source of continual worry to him. Libraries like this, of course, can be insured. But these books cannot be replaced at any price. He finally got to the point where he was too busy to enjoy his books, so he decided to let other collectors have the pleasure of acquiring them. Well, it was known to us that the collection had cost him somewhere in the neighborhood of $600,000, let's say $650,000. And just before the sale, someone asked him, "Well, Jerry, what would you take for the collection as it stands right now before the auction takes place?" He said, "I'd be satisfied with $700,000. The sale went on. After a day or two, I don't know at what, some point in the sale, a note was sent to me from the office giving me the total, which had just passed $1 million. And I received a telegram from Mr. Kern. The telegram read, "Tony, what the hell is going on?" So the second part of the sale, which followed the following week, went on, and finally the final total reached was $1,729,462.50, which is the highest ever known at any book sale in any part of the world.
Jerome Kern hit the jackpot with the sale of his books, and he hit a literary jackpot the day he was introduced to Oscar Hammerstein second. Their meeting, which was to prove a turning point in the history of the musical stage, occurred in a rather unusual place.
Well, oddly enough, we met in a cemetery. It was at the funeral of a famous composer. And I'm not quite sure whether it was Victor Herbert or somebody else. I'm under the impression that it was Victor Herbert's funeral.
The Kern-Hammerstein friendship flourished. They collaborated with Otto Harbach on the production of Sonny, a highly successful project. But the most important chapter in their partnership began with the ringing of a phone.
Jerry called me up one day when I was down at my Long Island home and said he had read half of a book, and he thought it would be great for us. And I said, "What book is that?" And he said, "Edna Ferber's Showboat." He said, "It's got a $1 million title to begin with, and I think it's wonderful. I've only read half, and I'd like to do it." So I bought a copy of the book and agreed with him, only I read the whole thing. Jerry and I independently made layouts of the story, a scenario of what we'd like to keep out of the book, and then we compared notes. And we had done an identical job. He had put in the same scenes that I wanted to keep out of the novel.
And so the book was chosen. Florence Ziegfeld was picked to produce it. All that remained was getting permission from the author to use her novel. Edna Ferber tells her own part in the story.
It was the late Alexander Wolcott who acted as matchmaker in the marriage between the novel entitled Showboat and the music of Jerome Kern. The happy union brought forth a musical play presented by Florence Ziegfeld at the Ziegfeld Theater in 1927. Alec Wolcott, at that time dramatic critic on the New York Times, invited me to go with him to the opening of a new musical play. It was Fred Stone in Stepping Stones at the Globe Theater. In the intermission, we drifted out to the lobby. A pixie-looking little man, whom I didn't know, with the most winning smile in the world, fought his way through the lobby crowd toward us. "Look, Alec," he said. "I hear, you know, Edna Ferber. Can you kind of arrange for me to meet her sometime soon? I want to talk to her about letting me make a musical play from her Showboat." Alec, with that dreadful relish for the dramatic, said musingly, "Well, it might just possibly be arranged. If you'll have patience and let me do things in my own way and..." "Oh, I will, Alec. I will. Thanks awfully. I'll be waiting." Now, Alec pounced on his dramatic moment. "Ferber, this is Jerome Kern. Jerry, Edna Ferber." It was done.
So far, everything was going like clockwork. But Ziegfeld, with Rio Rita already playing to a packed house every night, delayed the Showboat production for a year, and even then wasn't quite satisfied with the way it was shaping up. Charles Winninger, Captain Andy in the original production, remembers the polishing process.
"We were rehearsing in the Pennsylvania ballroom, and Kern was very, very happy about the show at the time, and he happened to remark to Mr. Ziegfeld, he says, 'Well,' he says, 'Boss,' he says, 'I think we've got a hit.' And Ziegfeld, in his sort of a nasal twang, says, 'Well,' he says, 'maybe we have and maybe we haven't.' He says, 'I would be happier if we had a hit song in the show. Something that people could whistle on the way out of the theater. Something like what you wrote for Marilyn Miller. Like, "Who are you waiting for? Who?" You know, one of those things. And then Kern, who was a little bit upset about this thing, he sat down at the piano, and in a sort of a tin-panny way, he played... And Ziggy said, "I think you've got something there." And Jerry Kern says, "Do you mean it?" And he says, "Yes." He says, "That's whistleable." He says, "I think the people will go out of the theater and whistle that." So Kern was kind of convinced about it, and then he turned around and he wrote that beautiful verse in the melody. Well, it stopped the show, and it sold more copies than all the rest of the songs in the show. Well, to make a long story short, it really was the whistling hit of the show, because people did go out of the theater whistling.
"Do I Love You" may have been the whistling hit of the show, but there's another number that will probably last even longer, and it provided Edna Ferber with a moment she'll never forget.
As the writing of the musical play by Oscar Hammerstein and Jerome Kern progressed, and its ups and downs were even more heartbreaking than those of most musical plays, I heard bits and pieces of the score. I heard "Can't Help Loving That Man" with its love-bemused lyric. I melted under the bewitching strains of "Only Make Believe" and of "Why Do I Love You?" and Gaylord Ravenel's insolent, careless gambler song. And then Jerome Kern appeared at my apartment late one afternoon with a strange look of quiet exultation in his eyes. He said, "I'd like you to hear a song. I've just finished it, and I'd like to know what you think of it." He sat down at the piano. He didn't play the piano particularly well, and his singing voice, though true, was negligible. He played and sang the music he had just written. It was a song called "Old Man River." The music mounted and mounted, and I give you my word, my hair stood on end. Tears came to my eyes. I knew that this wasn't just a musical comedy number. This was great music. This was music that would outlast Jerome Kern's day and my day and your day. And so it will.
Jerome Kern, the man and the music, will continue after this message from your announcer.
Before Kenneth Banghart returns with the final portion of tonight's biography in sound, I'd like to pass along this information about the next program in our series. December 27th, NBC Radio will present a biography in sound on Dr. Albert Schweitzer. Perhaps you saw his name in the papers a short time ago when Britain's Queen Elizabeth invested him with honorary membership in the Order of Merit, a group so exclusive there are only 24 members. Dr. Schweitzer's designation for this high honor is well deserved. Today, at the age of 80, he looks back on a brilliant career as scholar, philosopher, theologian, musician, and medical missionary. And at 80, he looks forward to still more service on behalf of mankind. He is, in the truest sense of the words, a universal man, a 20th century Leonardo da Vinci. So remember, a biography in sound on Dr. Albert Schweitzer, to be broadcast on December 27th by NBC Radio.
Now, a brief pause for station identification.
And now, NBC News continues with its presentation of Jerome Kern, the man and the music. Again is your narrator, Kenneth Banghart.
Showboat was first produced in 1927. It was, as we all know, an immediate and sustained hit. Almost every number in the score became familiar to an eager listening public. But to settle for that is to rob Showboat of its real significance. A significance that has become apparent only with the passage of almost 28 years since that first night curtain went up. For as we can now see, this is the show that lifted the Broadway musical drama out of a deep, well-worn rut and pointed out for the first time a fresh approach that is distinctly American in its origin. The man to sum it up in detail is Dr. Sigmund Spaeth, radio's longtime tune detective and now the editor of Music Journal. Dr. Spaeth.
Jerome Kern was certainly the man who influenced our modern musical stage more than anyone else. I think if it hadn't been for Showboat, we never would have had Pal Joey, Oklahoma, South Pacific, The King and I, Kiss Me Kate, Annie Get Your Gun, possibly Guys and Dolls, Pajama Games, shows of that sort. In other words, Jerome Kern was the first man, to my mind, to show how a musical show could be written with integrity, a show that made sense. A show with songs that advanced the action, that had something to do with the plot, that were not merely brought in helter-skelter in a haphazard way on a so-called music cue. Of course, we had that in the old days. We'd have an absurd plot, we'd have a very conventional comedian making some very bad jokes, and from time to time somebody would say, how about so-and-so, and that would be a song cue, and you'd have a song that was totally unrelated to the action or the characters who were singing it. That was true even of Victor Herbert, who wrote beautiful melodies, but when we try to revive his shows today, we find that the plots were of that old European type. Showboat was important not only because Jerome Kern was a pioneer in that field and really an epoch-making composer with a wonderful lyricist in Oscar Hammerstein's Second, but they also based that show on a great book by a great writer, Edna Ferber's Showboat. So we had there really a pioneer musical show for the Broadway stage that made it possible for Gershwin and the others to follow along.
This, then, is the contribution of Jerome Kern. But what kind of a man was he? What made him tick? I doubt that any one person knows the whole answer, but his closest friends can help close the gap. One of these was his arranger, Robert Russell Bennett.
I think I've seen Kern in practically every aspect in the world, and, of course, it would be silly for me to say I ever understood him, because I didn't. I understood his music, however. He was a very well-educated fellow. He studied, and he learned. He wasn't a deep student, but he learned all the things that go into his art, and he knew what they were. Just how profound a feeling he had for the intricacies of profound music, I don't know. I've heard him make music criticisms. Some very, very penetrating thoughts he had on symphonic compositions and serious music. And then other times I heard him say things that I just went off in the corner and buried my head.
Kern was, then, a man of contradictions, even where music is concerned. But also in his music, there is a constant factor. And a man who was in a position to see it clearly is his showboat collaborator, Oscar Hammerstein.
He had a gift for melody, and melody did come easy to him. But the actual structure of a song was hard work, as it is for everybody. I think Jerry's music expressed the America of his time, and still does. One feature of his music was that it never changed in style. He wrote through several trends, the operetta phase and the jazz phase and the light musical comedy phase, but Jerry's music was his own music, always the same, not repetitive as far as melody was concerned, but as far as style is concerned. He was certainly one of the greatest American composers who ever lived and ever contributed to our catalog of great songs.
Just as constancy of style is a clue to the Kern touch, so is another of his attributes. For Jerome Kern was a perfectionist. Nothing ever left his desk that he considered second best in quality. And as he expected perfection in himself, so did he seek it in others. Orchestra conductor Andre Kostolanitz knows that.
He was rehearsing one of his productions for a Broadway play, musical play, and he was stopping the singers, the second flute, and the smallest items. And I remember that one of his great collaborators came over to him and said, "Now, if you stop this performer, the second flutist about that note, no one can hear that. You took time to explain something that only you know." And Jerry said, "Yes, that is true. You're absolutely right. But by the time I stop 50 times during this act, everybody will know the difference. It will improve."
That's Kern, the perfectionist. And you could probably count on your hands the number of times he departed from that standard. And even then, the reason had to be good. Again, Andre Kostolanitz.
I have done quite a few of his scores, and I was the first one to play them. And I remember the one Sunday afternoon, my soloist was this great singer from the Metropolitan, Rize Stevens. And we had, I thought, a very brilliant first performance of this score. And when we were finished, the phone rang almost instantaneously with my last downbeat. And here was Jerry Kern from Hollywood. And he sounded elated. He was full of the sort of compliments that every conductor likes to hear when a composer tells him, especially the first performance. But then suddenly his voice dropped about two octaves, and he sounded a little sad, and he says, "Tell me, why did Rize Stevens change one word in that song long ago and far away?" Well, you know, a conductor seldom can hear in a broadcast the actual words that the singers sing, because the orchestra is usually quite loud. And the first thing that came to my mind was Miss Stevens' condition at that point. And I simply said, "Jerry, you know, she's pregnant." Oh, he says, then it's all right. That seemed to have solved everything.
It could just possibly be that there was a sentimental streak in Jerome Kern. Another young lady who has ample reason to think so is the Hollywood and Broadway lyricist Dorothy Fields. Her first contact with Kern, however, began with quaking knees and well-gnawed fingernails. Miss Fields.
I wonder if you'd like to hear about the first song I wrote without Jerome Kern. It sounds strange, doesn't it? But actually, I did write it without him. I was doing a picture at RKO. And at the same time, on the lot, they were doing a picture of Roberta, a musicalization taken from the stage play. Of course, they had all the numbers. I was reworking some lyrically and doing a little extra dialogue. And there was one number of Jerome Kern's, one melody. It didn't have a lyric, but they owned the melody and they wanted to use it because it was very lovely. So Pandro Berman, who produced the picture, called me in one day and he said, "We need something for the fashion show. You've rewritten the fashion show for Freddie Astaire, but we need something for Irene Dunne to sing because we're expecting to put her in a costume that costs about $8,000. And she really should sing something in anything as expensive as that." So he said, "I'd like it to be a song that could be used both as something to show off clothes in a fashion show and that could be one of the love songs in the picture." It was a kind of tall order. And he played the melody, which I loved. He said, "Now, do you suppose you could have this by, like, tomorrow morning?" And, of course, that's the way they did things in those days. But I was very much younger and very ambitious and a little frightened at the idea of doing anything written by Mr. Kern, who I didn't know. And I said, "Well, does Mr. Kern know that I'm supposed to do this?" He said, "No, but, well, let's see how it is first." Well, the song was, and the title I luckily got was Lovely to Look At. And Pandro was excited about it, and Irene Dunne loved it, and they decided to go ahead and produce it. All this time, Jerry Kern was in the East and didn't know very much about what was going on at RKO. But nevertheless, Irene Dunne appeared in this beautiful $8,000 costume, and they built a set, and they did a wonderful orchestration and had a fashion show. And the whole thing was what they called in the can, which meant it had been shot and produced. And then they sent Mr. Kern a record. Well, nobody on the lot at RKO slept for two or three nights because you can imagine what would happen if it turned out that Jerry Kern didn't like it. Well, he did like it. He liked it very much. And he came out to California a few weeks after, and he wanted to meet me because he was to do another picture for Lily Pons with Henry Fonda. And he said, "I think I'd like Dorothy Fields to do the lyrics." And that was the first time I was presented to Mr. Kern. And when I met him, walked into the room, kind of shaking a bit, he left the piano and came up and kissed me. Well, that was the start of a very wonderful association with Jerome Kern and myself.
That was Jerome Kern, lavish with praise and affection if he thought you deserved it, and equally stern if he thought the occasion demanded that. And through it all, both in Hollywood and in New York, he burned his energy at a furious rate every waking hour of the day. At length, the pace began to tell. The outside world didn't know the true story, but Robert Russell Bennett did.
Toward the end of his career, he had a terrible sickness. We were working there in Hollywood. I had gone out especially to do the orchestrations, arrange the music of High, Wide, and Handsome, and I had been seeing Jerry Kern every day, and one day his wife called me up and said he wouldn't be in, said he was not very well. And he would be all right, but he was not very well. For some reason or other, the seriousness of his illness was either not apparent to him or they didn't want the world to know that this great man was as low as he was. He was stricken with a heart condition. And he actually is said by doctors to have died. But the miracles of modern medicine were able to bring him back. And he lived 8 years after that, during which time he wrote such hits as Long Ago and Far Away, All the Things You Are, and quite a number of other very beautiful songs. He always referred to himself as living on borrowed time.
Most of us, I suppose, would be tempted to let well enough alone after an experience like that, to sit in the corner in our rocking chairs, but not Jerome Kern. True, the pace was slower now, but the beautiful melodies continued to flow from his pen. And one of the most beautiful, is remembered by his attorney, Howard Reinheimer.
I recall in the spring of 1940, Oscar Hammerstein and I happened to be going to California, and we were in the same car on the Chief. In the course of the trip, Oscar kept himself confined to his compartment, and when he emerged upon arriving at Los Angeles, he had completed the lyric of a song which he had only commenced at the start of the trip. The very next morning, I dropped in at Jerry Kern's house to pay him my usual visit on my arrival in California. In great excitement, he dragged me over to his piano and sat down and with one hand, with his right hand, battered out the notes to a new melody that he informed me he had just completed. I looked at the lyrics, and there was the song, The Last Time I Saw Paris.
I Saw Paris, written on borrowed time. Also a part of these later years is a warm picture of Kern the man. Again, Dorothy Fields.
I was with him so much, I think from about 1934 until 1938. I was with him constantly. I was part of that family, and they were part of my family. And it wasn't a question of any formality. I would run over in the morning, and Jerry would be out doing something, some bit of business, like going to the farmer's market or looking for an antique. And I'd have coffee with Eva in the breakfast room. And when he'd come in, we'd sit down, start to work. And then he'd think of something else he wanted to do, like finding out from the bookie what horses were good in the third race at Santa Anita. So he'd knock off work to do that for a little while. And he loved to play. And every night, I think for 2 years when the game Monopoly first came out, we used to play every single night. Eva Kern, Jerry Kern, Betty Kern, and Johnny or Dick Green, who were around the house at the time, myself. And we'd play till 2 or 3 in the morning. And there was always a kind of family feeling about my association with the Kerns.
It was soon after these happy days that Dorothy Fields moved to New York. The Kerns stayed in Hollywood. And then in 1945, plans were laid to put Showboat back on the New York stage. And for Jerome Kern, there was only one place to be, backstage at the theater, supervising the revival of his finest Broadway show. Once more, Dorothy Fields.
Jerry and Eva were coming east, and Oscar and Dick, I think, were going to revive Showboat. And, of course, being such great friends, we had made an appointment to have dinner with Eva and Jerry the night after they arrived, but I was having lunch with Eva the day after they arrived. I called early in the morning. Eva slept late, but Jerry was up, shaving. And as he answered the phone, he said, "All right, you know better than to wake us up at this hour. I'll leave a message for Eva on the washstand mirror." And he wrote a message in soap on the mirror that said, "Meet Dorothy at Pavillon at 1 o'clock. So I met Eva for lunch at 1 o'clock at Pavillon. And we had a wonderful lunch and sat over many cups of coffee, as Eva and I usually do. And she walked me to Tiffany's, and then she was going back to the St. Regis. The next thing I knew, there was a message for me home to go to Welfare Island. You see, Jerry had intended to leave the St. Regis where they were living and to walk around to Ackerman, the antique shop on 57th Street, to buy a brake front. And he walked up Park Avenue, and as he passed the Bible Institute, he collapsed. He had no identification, except an ASCAP button. And when the ambulance picked him up, they rushed him over to Welfare Island and called ASCAP. They finally reached Oscar Hammerstein, who called me, of course called Eva first, and we all went to Welfare Island, where we spent about 4 days. Jerry was unconscious, and they had put him in a ward, but all the little old men there agreed to be pushed and huddled together so that this great man could have his bed in a great long room just screened by white screens. And we sat there day after day. Finally, they moved Jerry up to Doctor's Hospital. He never regained consciousness, although they tried so hard to get through to him. And finally, someone said, "Oscar, why don't you go upstairs to Jerry's room and sing the song he loved better than any song he ever wrote?" And that song was, "I've Told Every Little Star." And so Oscar leaned over and sang it very softly into Jerry's ear. And Oscar says sometimes, "Well, maybe I did see the flicker of an eyelid. Maybe he didn't." But Jerry never did regain consciousness, and he died on a Sunday morning in November.
This has been a special transcribed presentation by NBC News.